Hello, you're welcome to Inside Education. The website of the program is insideed.com, where you can listen to or download podcasts of all previous Inside Education programs. I'm Sean Delaney, and you can follow the program on Twitter with the handle @InsideEd. Earlier this year, I attended the 42nd Annual Conference of the Computers and Education Society of Ireland, or CESI for short, in Galway. I've already brought you some of the interviews I recorded at the conference, and this week I bring you three more. We'll hear about the youth media team and how one academic would like us to be careful about how computational thinking is developed in schools. But first, I spoke to Leanne Lynch, who is a primary school teacher in St Mary's Convent Primary School in Neenah. She is in her fourth year of teaching, and in our conversation she describes a project she conducted last year with her second class. The project was themed on space and conducted using a range of technologies. I began by asking Leanne to tell me about the project.
Last year, I was teaching second class and we explored a unit of work on space, and it was entitled Somewhere Over the Rainbow, and we integrated Glogster EDU, which is a multimedia poster tool, and Skype in our learning.
It's Glogster, is it?
Yes, Glogster EDU. So essentially, it is a poster multimedia tool giving the children an opportunity to write information, insert images and videos that they sourced on the internet. And also, the great thing about this website and this tool is that the children can actually upload images, video content and audio files that they have created in class, making it far more meaningful than anything that they could possibly find online. And also, you're actually not dealing with copyright issues then, because it's very much authentic in what's going on. And that's how we used Glogster last year. If Somewhere Over the Rainbow was divided into four sub-components, and they were each explored over a two-week period. So we had the 1969 moon landing, and the children in their groups actually created a Glogster poster on that, based on our learning, everything that we did, from our English to the musical compositions to the artwork. So the images went up, they spoke about them, and they just showcased their learning. And it was a great way to, I suppose, publish what they had done. Because they were working in groups, they were developing their communication and collaborative skills. For the second sub-component of the whole project, we explored the sun. And we actually connected with a lecturer of physics in Trinity College in Dublin, Dr. Peter Gallagher, via Skype. And it was fantastic because the burning questions that the children had, they were able to ask them of Dr. Peter Gallagher, and he was just fantastic with them, spoke to them at their level. Then the next phase was crash landing site, and again in the school grounds the children discovered that there was a rocket, it had crashed, they had to go investigate, and they had pens at the ready and whiteboards at the ready, but also my mobile phone, because we don't have mobile devices in our school, but I didn't want that to inhibit using technology. So I used my mobile phone and recorded the children what they saw. They were describing the scene and using vivid language, and that was captured, and just the voice recorder, and I took some video footage as well.
And did you create the supposed crash site yourself?
And then we actually connected with Commander Chris Hadfield. Now, for anybody who doesn't know who he is, he actually was the first Canadian to walk in space. He flew two space shuttle missions and he served as commander of the International Space Station. So I actually thought, wouldn't it just be fantastic, seeing as we are exploring space and this unit of work on space, and we have been connecting with lecturers and people with expert knowledge, but wouldn't it be just so authentic if you could ask questions of somebody who was there, lived through the experience, and could offer, you know, insights and stories that another may not be able to. Now, of course, you can access a lot of this online, because Chris Hadfield has many YouTube videos posted, and of course he's on Twitter quite regularly. But I said I may as well try and make contact. So I did, and thankfully a member working on his team responded to an email that I sent. And from there, a number of emails were exchanged, and we organised for a date and a time for it to take place. And he spent about a half an hour with us. And not only my second class now, I actually extended the invitation to the other teachers in the school. From second to sixth class, we were all together in the school hall. My girls in my class and their groups, they asked the questions, but everyone got to actually listen to this world famous astronaut speak.
How did you go about preparing and planning for this quite extensive project?
There was extensive planning and preparation required. I knew there were going to be four subcomponents, and like that, I was hoping that in the children's groups that they would create a Gloucester poster. But I also incorporated the Skype calls with experts just to enhance the children's learning. Basically, I just came up with this story to excite the children. So NASA got in contact with the school, and they wanted the children to help Dr. Max Bernstein and his team with their latest investigative studies. And they asked the children, would they be interested in conducting research in groups together, forwarding their findings to Dr. Max Bernstein, and if the findings were deemed satisfactory, that they would then be able to make progress onto another mission.
So this was your invention?
Oh, it completely was. And I think, you know, in primary school, you come up with these stories, anything just to get the children engaged. And they very much were. I asked my principal to deliver this message because I wanted the children to genuinely really believe it. And he got into role. It was fantastic because coming from the principal, it had to be true. So basically the whole story, it went from week to week, and each of the phases, it just all rolled into one. And it was lovely. Yeah, it was very enjoyable.
And did you, you know, develop it as you went along, or did you start off at the outset knowing exactly where this was all going to head?
I pretty much had it planned from the outset, knowing that we were going to do the moon landing first and then onto the sun and onto the crash landing and onto life in space. I had hoped even to explore the planets in greater detail, but this was an 8-week project. As I said, the four components, 2 weeks each, and it was sufficient. I didn't need to do anything more. But I have to say, it wasn't just all about fun. I mean, there was a purpose behind it. The children worked together in groups. They were brainstorming. They were critically thinking, problem solving, and expressing themselves. And I felt that through the whole process, there were issues, collaborative issues, where there were falling ins and fallings out and whatnot, but they had to deal with them, and they did, and they learned what it was to work together as a group. And I also felt that their communication skills developed because of the fact they had so many opportunities to express themselves. And you know, you think Skype, okay, fair enough, we all do it, but getting children to work together in groups and analyse the information that they have, knit it all together, and then come up with meaningful questions that they want to ask of experts, questions that they don't know the answers to already. So we were looking for instance, when they spoke with Commander Hadfield, not so much the information that we could find online. We wanted to know more about his experience, what he felt like when that rocket, you know, took off. Because it's hard, it's wonderful to actually capture that in words, listening to somebody, as opposed to maybe reading it. It doesn't mean the same thing.
Was it the technology or was it the idea that came first? Or how did you decide that you were going to be using a lot of technology in this project?
Because myself personally, I have a huge interest in thematic cross-curricular learning. I wanted to incorporate both. I wanted that element of a theme being explored, but using technology maybe to enhance the children's learning. And if it didn't enhance the children's learning, to document that. Or if there were issues, to document that. Because not everything goes so plain sailing, and it's not all smooth. The more things go wrong and the more mistakes that are made and the more failures, the better. Because we learn from these experiences.
Did you find that you were able to get the parents more involved using Gloucester?
Oh, for sure. Because each of the groups had a username and password for Gloucester, meaning they could access it in school and at home. Not all of them did access it at home, because I actually had some children without computers or mobile devices and internet access. Not very many, just a couple. But and some actually loved doing it at home. They spoke to their parents about it and they got involved from that perspective. And I spoke with parents, three actually, and we in a formal interview, in a formal capacity at the end of the project, and they spoke about the fact that their children were coming home, speaking about what they were doing in school and then showing them in the evening time. And at the end of the project, actually, I think it was week 8 when it was all coming together. We were after going to Burr Observatory and enjoying a day out and all the rest, organised by NASA, of course, as a token of their appreciation. We as a class invited the parents to come in and enjoy a day of celebration. So they got to hear and listen to their own children presenting their Gloucester posters in their groups, so actually expressing themselves in front of a live audience. They were so proud of themselves, and of course the parents were delighted to see their little ones up there.
And do you have any plans to do something similar in the future?
It just dawned me that I haven't yet thought of Skyping with another class, another school, and actually conversing Trivan na Gaeilge. So with my sixth class. So in the next couple of weeks, I hope to organise something like that. Again, simple. We all have teaching colleagues, maybe in different counties or different classes, and maybe even in Gaelscoileanna. And it's very easy to set up a Skype call.
Indeed it is. And that was Leanne Lynch, a sixth class teacher in St Mary's Convent Primary School in Nenagh. You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Podcasts of previous programmes can be downloaded from iTunes or from our website insideed.com. This week I'm speaking to workshop presenters at this year's conference of the Computers and Education Society of Ireland. Next I spoke to Richard Millwood, who is the course director for the Masters in Learning Technology in the School of Computer Science and Statistics in Trinity College Dublin. His interest is in computational thinking, asking questions like whether or not young children should learn to program, and if so, what the implications of that are for the entire education system. I began by asking Richard Millwood to tell me what his presentation at SESI was about.
I actually presented with three colleagues from Trinity College in Dublin, and our presentation was about computational thinking. Our position is that computational thinking has become a very fashionable and interesting topic for schools to consider teaching, but we think that there isn't enough research to give a clarity about what it is, about how it should be progressed through the school stages, and how it should be continued into the rest of one's life. So we're interested in computational thinking across the life course, making it joined up, helping teachers to understand what it is and what they can do with it, and also questioning and being sceptical, as you'd expect a good academic to be, about whether or not the very fashionable and rushed job, in our opinion, in some countries, like England, is wise. You know, should we go in and start teaching five-year-olds to program? Should we not? This isn't well thought through, we think. We used to teach programming in the 1980s in England. We stopped doing so pretty much as the 90s progressed. Why are we coming back to it? And have we learnt the lessons of history? Do we have the evidence base to build a sound educational practice?
And from what you've seen so far, do we?
I think teachers are very clear in their own hearts and minds about what they're doing. But of course, teachers act, relatively speaking, individually, although we can help to be collective. So, for example, I heard some very exciting presentations this morning before my own about the use of BBOT in early years, you know, age 6, 7. Pretty young to be doing programming, you'd think. And moving on to working with Scratch, I think these teachers were very successful in what they were doing, and they had a very clear rationale for why they were doing it. And in particular, they could point to success in emotional development and social development, not just in, if you like, cognitive development around programming or something of that kind. I was excited by that. The questions are, do the other teachers that surround them in the ecosystem of schools understand what they're doing? Do the schools that these young people are going on to next understand? Will they have a fulfilling life in second level if they've done all that programming stuff in first level and then they're taught it all again in second level? You know, these are the questions. And this is not to mention the question of what happens when they go to university to do computing. Are the lecturers that work there at that level ready for this changing scene of people prepared for programming?
And what kind of programming languages are being used by schools in teaching this computational thinking?
To be accurate, computational thinking is arguably a broader area than just programming. So programming languages are taught to teach programming and hoped for extensions to a broader sense of what computational thinking is. But to answer your question directly, the answer is Scratch is probably number one. But of course, before Scratch, take the BBOT, the little robot that I was talking about and heard about this morning, the programming language is actually pressing buttons. It's not actually text. It is not code as we currently understand it. And indeed, Scratch is not text in a strong sense. It is. There are words in it, of course, and there are numbers in it. But it's mostly about jigsaw pieces that you reassemble on the screen to make a program. And this is a very important opportunity. It means bringing the difficulty level down to a much younger age group who can manipulate these shapes, enjoy the creativity that's involved in constructing a program with shapes, and end up with something that works really well and does something very exciting as well.
This is different to, say, for example, other kinds of thinking, like critical thinking and other forms of thinking. How do you see computational thinking informing teaching?
What we have to ask is, why is computational thinking suddenly this wonderful and important form of thinking? And as you said, we have to do the research. We have to discover how it collides with critical thinking, problem solving, perhaps emotional intelligence, another term that was used this morning, and I thought very interestingly. We have to try and work that out, and I don't think it's well worked out at the moment. It's just another kind of exciting bandwagon at the moment, to some degree. And that's being unkind to the people that have put lots of time and effort into it. I don't wish to in any way disrespect their work. But at the same time, I'd like to see the joining up done rather better and a bit of an understanding of the balance between these things and how they inform each other.
I suppose the reason I'm kind of surprised that there isn't more research on this area is because when I was learning to be a teacher in the mid-80s, we were encouraged to use logo programming. And I duly did so in the classroom. And it just seems amazing that 30 years later, we yes. don't have the research findings about how helpful that programming was for the students who used it.
You've nailed it. I mean, you know, to me, it's fantastic to imagine that we are going to now relaunch into, in many cases, in many countries across the world, an idea of computing and programming as being so central, when we haven't examined properly why did Logo die out? It effectively did. I mean, one of the things that has spurred us to re-examine programming in the last few years is the knowledge that there was a decline in schools computing. And the graph of participation at that second level, admittedly towards, you know, university entrance level, that graph was declining across the UK, across Ireland and Northern Ireland, and certainly in the States and other countries besides. And it spurred the current growth. Now, why did it get to that point is the question I don't think has been properly answered or discovered.
And it means then that a lot of the engagement with the technology is at a more passive level.
I think that's a misunderstanding. But the truth is that for a much larger majority of children, the creative use of ICT can be much more fulfilling than programming can be. For some, programming is hard, difficult, challenging, where at the same time they could be making videos, they could be being sociable, communicating on the internet, making web pages, being quite creative, quite engaged and fulfilled by an ICT curriculum, if only we were to conceive of it in that way. So I think there's been a damning of ICT, and it's refreshing to see in the draft national strategy for Ireland a kind of confidence in ICT across the curriculum, rather than as in the UK, where it's been rubbished to some degree.
Can you just say a little bit about what other strands to computational thinking there are other than, say, the programming?
Arguably, programming is when you get to the nitty-gritty of making the computer do stuff. But computational thinking might well include the kind of thinking that happens when you take your CDs in the past, not so much now, and put them into order on the shelf, or your books, you know. Or you access an old-fashioned library index and have to look through the cards. And if you like, the generalised idea of coding things, like in ciphers, Morse code and so on, that doesn't involve computers. And so you could argue computational thinking has this broader application beyond actually making a computer do something.
Well, that reminds me of an interview I had here with two years ago. I think it was with John Naughton, but I could be wrong, where he said that computer programming can be taught without computers.
Well, that's right. And Computing Unplugged is a well-respected website, which people should go and have a look at. What we were doing is simply taking from it and using it to make our points in our workshop. I think it is exciting that we can have children who are more creative and can change the world. And the argument is that computational thinking is going to help them when it comes to designing solutions to problems and solutions that can be achieved through the use of computer systems in a broader sense. And when I say computer systems, I'm not just meaning the technology itself, but the people that work around it, the ways they work together, that needs designing. And computational thinking will help them design more effectively in that world than otherwise.
And that was Richard Millwood of TCD on the ways in which computational thinking can help students design solutions to problems using computer systems. Finally this week, I spoke to Bernie Goldbach. Bernie is a multimedia lecturer at the Clonmel campus of Limerick Institute of Technology. He's also associated with the Youth Media Team, a group of teenagers who attend various conferences and conduct interviews with the presenters. I began our interview by asking Bernie to tell me about the Youth Media Team.
Youth Media Team is a group of teenagers who have an interest in interviewing people about what they're doing at an event that they're attending. Typically, they're talking to educators, but sometimes they've interviewed journalists like Matt Cooper, Fintan O'Toole, rugby players, well, you might call them Brezzy, and entertainers. They've interviewed Ryan Tuberty. It gives the young person a chance to say, I'm confident enough to ask a question. I'll doorstep somebody or I'll get hooked up with that person and I'll stay focused so that I'll get my 3 to 4 questions out before I tremble and walk away. So the Youth Media Team, teenagers, most of them are 4th, 5th year, and they're interested in not necessarily going to journalism, but instead just spending a weekend mingling with sometimes their parents or friends of them, friends of friends, attending events that they would normally go to as teenagers. So it's a little bit of courage required to pull it off and a little bit of finishing, being able to articulate and to actually hold the line with a question and maybe do a follow-up question. You know, in your own line of work, that's hard to do. It's hard to get the confidence to actually ask somebody you've never met before more than the time of day.
And one of the harder things is even to listen to the answers you're getting.
That's right. And that's why it's really clever, you know, after 3 or 4 times of doing it, to watch them get the courage for the follow-on question or to cut across when they think, wait a minute, he's not really answering my question. I'll rephrase this here. That's really nice to see.
And where do these youngsters come from?
They normally are like 1 degree of separation from people attending the event. So like I would go to the event, none of my kids are members of this youth media team, but I work with educators, third level educators who go to different events and they bring their kids with them if this opportunity exists. So normally they're paid in members of a conference and they happen to have the kids come in with them for the weekend. So we put the red shirts on them, we give them the training before the fact, give them the training the night before again, practice a few runs, and then they come in hot, normally working with teams of 2, taking a photo of the setting as well as recording a 3 to 5 minute spot.
So it's a kind of a mobile team. It's a different team of interviewers every time.
Well, we'd like that, but in actuality, we need the continuity of those who've gone before. So normally 1/2 of the team has done it at least 1 time in the last 3 months. It's just to make sure we're not retraining a whole group of new people. Sometimes the technology misbehaves, so they need to know they can roll back, and they're always recording with more than one device because we've had situations where someone's forgot to push the record button on the primary device. It happens to everybody.
Indeed it does. I can definitely vouch for that. And when you say there's training for them, what kind of training do they get?
I train third-level students in media principles, so media writing and some theoretical things like narrative or critical studies, contextual studies. I also have the gear. We were borrowing some microphones or some portable recording devices from the main campus in LIT. So I would give them the training for that. So keep it basic and saying, you record me, and after I show you how to do it, I'll record you to show you how I would have done it a little bit differently. Then you do it again. And in a space of 30 minutes, we can pretty much show them how they would know with great confidence that what they thought they're doing, they did. They recorded it. They started the recording the way it was supposed to go. And they have the confidence knowing that that first 20 or 30 seconds talking to somebody, that they didn't mess up with a manual task. In terms of being able to give them the confidence, that comes only with time. You know, the older you get, theoretically, the more confident you get. So we don't necessarily give them training in elocution or presentation skills. The young people come to us probably interested in doing it, so we don't have to push them to do it. And they just watch someone else do it who's done it before, and they get the confidence of expression to try it themselves. Some of these teenagers have done really, really well with it, and they don't want to be presenters. They just want to present themselves in some other line of work.
And how do you know that there's a critical mass of people who want to take part in a particular event, that it's actually worth your while going there and, you know, training them and supporting them?
We actually see them coming towards us through Twitter or Facebook or YouTube. So we have one young man who's a vlogger. He's been doing video logs for probably since the age of 10 in his bedroom. two or three other people. They started maybe interviewing their parents about the jobs they had or the stories of their life, and we'd listen to them on different networks like SoundCloud or Audio Boom, and they percolate towards us. The parents say, "We hear you're in Kerry next month. Would you mind?" Talk, and we just connect up that way. So normally the young teenager would have done something on her own or his own volition to put himself in a space that we'd pick up, and then they nudge us either through the parents or directly saying, "How do I do this?" So we don't have to recruit. That there's enough interest by people who want to create to end up in that same shared creative space. It's lovely.
Is it hard to build up a community given that the people differ so much? I mean, it seems to me that there's a certain level of continuity, but there's a lot of differences as well from one week. Is it week to week?
No, we really don't go out more than once every 2 months. So you wouldn't be breaking the back of a family routine with that kind of rotation. The only pressure we feel in terms of scheduling is if someone's going into some serious examination cycle, and we don't want to compromise that at all.
And if somebody is interested in getting involved, is the best thing to do to try and contact you through Twitter?
Yeah, I'd say you can talk to YMTFM. That's the youth media team at YMTFM. That's YMT.FM on the internet. I am Top Gold on all good social networks, and I work with Pamela A. O'Brien. The big thing that we're doing in April is the ICE Teen Education event the last Saturday in April in LIT Thurles. So that's hashtag ICTEDU online as well.
And if anybody wanted to hear the podcasts that you create, how can they?
The easiest thing is go to the Twitter, Nick, YMTFM, and just look at the links that are, they look to be audio links. They actually say things like click to play, or there'll be a little player in line for it. Just look at that, and then you'll end up in a cluster of stuff, a little rabbit hole that you can explore with your own time. YMTFM, just go there.
And why not? That was Bernie Goldbach bringing this week's Inside Education to a close. You can listen to podcasts of previous Inside Education programs on insideed.com or on iTunes. You can email me at insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Thanks to Leanne Lynch, Richard Millwood and Bernie Goldbach, and to the organising committee of SESI 2015, especially Anne McMorrow and John Heffernan. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.